Good evening, and I certainly trust that you've had a pleasant day. We're glad that you're with us this evening, and tonight we look at a lesson from the final book of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi, and this is the last word of prophecy that God gave for about 400 years until the events of the New Testament began to happen. Now, in that 400 years of prophetic silence, a lot of things happened. And there are some fairly reliable histories, we think, for that intertestamental period, as it's called. And some Bibles do contain these books. They're called the apocryphal books. Again, they are not inspired works. But the books of 1st and 2nd and possibly 3rd Maccabees is interesting reading. Again, it's from a historical perspective, and it tells about a lot of the events that were prophesied actually in the book of Daniel. But this is the final Old Testament book, and tonight we're going to look at some of the things that can happen and some of the reasons why sometimes God's people get bored. It seems that that's what kind of happened in some of these instances and what Malachi was sent to address. But we hear that a lot at times. I'm bored. Kids with, you know, they've got toys like you and I never dreamed about, and yet they're bored. Or the successful entrepreneur who is now bored with all of his or her possessions and treasures. The mansion's not enough. The pool is not enough. Their private golf course is not enough. Their private jet is not enough. Trips to the Caribbean at a whim are not enough. They're bored. Who else says I'm bored? Sometimes the Christian who doesn't properly appreciate spiritual blessings. Now, Malachi is writing here after the Jews had, you know, they had overcome a lot of obstacles, and they had returned from Babylonian captivity, and they are back in the promised land. They have rebuilt the temple. They have resumed worship. But instead of rejoicing in all that God had done for them, they became bored. And thus we have the message of Malachi. His name means my messenger. And he is writing during the Persian period after, of course, the exiles had returned to Judah. He's writing somewhere around 450, 425 BC. And there are three main purposes in this brief New Testament, or brief Old Testament book. Number one, he is desiring to correct some of the abuses that the returning Jews had made. The corruption of the priesthood, the corruption and the offering of the sacrifices that were polluted. In other words, they had marred worship to God. They had a rampant divorce rate. And they were failing to properly return to their Lord. They weren't tithing properly. And so that's one of the reasons. The second reason was he wanted to warn the Jews of coming judgment. Now, they had just gotten out of a judgment. You know, they were in Babylonian captivity for 70 years as a judgment. And God sent Nebuchadnezzar as his servant, that wicked king of the Babylonians, and they took the Jews into captivity, 586. So they had just gotten out of that. And now Malachi is going to warn them, hey, you guys better get back on track, because it could happen again. Or something worse. And then the third reason was to promise the messenger in the likeness of Elijah, which, of course, since we have all the information now, we know that this was a prophecy regarding John the Immerser. But I want to talk specifically about what happened to these children of God when they got bored with worship, for the first point. They got bored with going to church. They got bored with Bible study. And as we look at Malachi chapter 1, beginning in verse 6, the record says, "A son honoreth his father, and a servant his master. If then I be a father, where is mine honor? And if I be a master, where is my fear? Saith Jehovah of hosts unto you, O priests that despise my name. And ye say, wherein has we despised your name?" Well, he responds, "You offer polluted bread upon me altar. And you say, wherein have we polluted thee? In that you say, the table of the Lord is contemptible." The priests who were charged with putting brand new showbread on the altar, they weren't doing their job. Either they were leaving the showbread there and it was turning moldy, or they were putting less than pristine examples of the showbread on the table. In short, they were not offering their best to God. So in verse 7, they were offering polluted bread upon the altar. And then they were saying, "How have we polluted thee, God? You're not giving me your best. What do you mean we're not giving you our best?" Well, he goes on in verse 8. They were offering blind animals as sacrifices. In verse 8 he says, "If ye offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And if ye offer the lame and the sick, is it not evil? Offer it now unto thy governor. Will he be pleased with thee, or accept thy person, saith the Lord of hosts?" God is saying, you're giving me the blind, the lame, the animals that are not pristine subjects. He says, you take that to your local government official and see if they'll take it. You're going to give the best to your earthly leaders, and you're going to give God the scraps. That's what he's saying. But isn't that sometimes what man does? We give the best of our time, the best of our money, the best of our attention to worldly pursuits, and, oh, well, if I'm not too tired on Sunday, then I'll go to church. If I have enough money left in my bank account after I buy all the things I want, then I'll throw God a token bone. Once my favorite TV show's over, if I'm not too tired, I may read the Bible a little bit. He says in verse 9, "Now pray, I beseech you, that God will be gracious unto us. This hath been by your means, Will he regard your person, saith the Lord of hosts? Who is there even among you that would shut the doors for nothing, for naught? Neither do you kindle fire on mine altar for naught. I have no pleasure in you, saith Jehovah of hosts. Neither will I accept an offering at your hand. God was not happy with the way he was being treated by those who were to be called his children. And the priests were getting, they were getting very complacent. That would be, I don't know how you would handle it if you found out that, well, what's John doing up so late on a Saturday night? Well, he's scouring the internet for tomorrow's sermon. Don't ever accept a preacher like that. Don't accept a preacher who does not appreciate the Word of God, who does not take what the Bible says seriously. And if you feel that ever about me, come to me, love me enough to tell me. We'll address your concerns. But I promise you this day that I take these words very seriously. And I'm not scouring the internet for sermons. There's enough right here in this book. There was a story told of a preacher, a young preacher who was graduating from Bible college. And much to his surprise, he was hired by a congregation before he was ready. I mean, he was sent to this congregation pretty quick out of graduating. And he thought, boy, I just don't have enough sermons. And he wrote to an older preacher and says, could you send me a few sermon outlines to help get me by until I get established with this church? And as the story goes, the older preacher sent him a copy of the New Testament and said, here are your sermons, some assembly required. That's exactly what he should have done. But they were getting bored with church. Here we go again. Select the best lamb or the best calf or the best goat and bring it to the priest for sacrifice. We did it last week. We got to do it this week. And I suppose we'll have to do it next week. We just, it's the same thing over and over again. And in chapter 1 and verse 13, look what they said. God says, you say, behold, what a weariness it is. And ye have snuffed at it, saith the Lord of hosts. And ye brought that which was torn, and the lame, and the sick. Thus ye brought an offering. Should I accept this out of your hand, saith Jehovah? They say, oh, what a weariness. Oh, how mundane it is. Here we go. Sing two songs, stand for a prayer, sit down and sing another song, and then the preacher gets up and blah, 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 and then we stand and sing an invitation song, and boy, we hope nobody responds because we want to get home in time to see our TV show. They were getting bored with church, and Christians get bored today. They had degraded into half-hearted worship. They were offering the blind and the lame animals. They weren't building a fire on the altar as they should have been doing. And so Malachi's message is this. There's nothing wrong with God's prescription for worship. The problem lay within how the people were viewing the God of heaven. If they were not giving their best, he said in verse 10, shut the doors. Who is there among you that would shut the doors for nothing? In other words, if you're not going to give God your best, you may as well shut the doors. The effect is going to be the same. I mean, you can come here week after week, three times a week, and offer God impure worship. You can offer God unsatisfactory offerings, or you can stay home and do what you want to do, the result will be the same. God is a spirit, and we have to worship God in spirit and in truth. And they were not doing that. And that's why Malachi is sent. Regardless of what we have, or regardless of what we don't have, God expects and deserves our best. And brethren and friends, I'm here to tell you, He will accept nothing less. The lesson for us is this. If we are bored with worship, we need to look inwardly. We do here at 10th and Claremont exactly what the Bible prescribes. We can't go beyond what God has authorized. We're not allowed to just say, well, we're not going to do this part of it. We do what the Bible authorizes, what the Bible commands. And if that is not satisfactory to you, then you need to look inwardly, because we are doing God's will. Now, I can't make you be interested in it. You can't make me be passionate about what I preach. If I'm not passionate about what I preach, I don't look and blame you. That's on me. You will get out of worship what you put in to worship. I get out of worship what I put in to worship. That's all anybody can do. What is my relationship with God? Why do I worship God? Do I stand up here and preach to impress you? No. I stand up here and preach to impress upon you the gospel, the power of God unto salvation. Do I give my best to God, or do I simply fit God into my schedule? That's a question we need to answer seriously. So they were bored with worship. Secondly, they had become bored with marriage. Now, that may seem like a non sequitur, but it's very much related. How is marriage related to worship? And how is marriage related to whether or not I am bored as a Christian or as a child of God? Well, the reason it's related is because many people fail to recognize and understand God's nature. Now, of all the descriptives we could talk about, we say, well, God is a God of love. Yes, He is. He is a God of goodness. Yes, He is. He is a God of justice. Yes, He is. But He is also a God of covenants. A covenant, that's an arrangement. That's a relationship between two parties. And for a covenant to remain intact, it is absolutely vital that both sides keep their end of the covenant. God is a God of covenants. Look at chapter 2 of Malachi, verses 4 and 5. And we'll just notice the language that Malachi is writing here. And ye shall know that I have sent this commandment unto you, that my covenant might be with Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. My covenant was with him of life and peace, and I gave them him for the fear wherewith he feared me and was afraid before my name. We see in verses 8 and 10, but ye are departed out of the way, ye have caused many to stumble at the law. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi. Verse 10, have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously every man against thy brother? By profaning the covenants of our fathers. We see in chapter 3, verse 1. Behold, I will send my messenger, and he shall prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom you seek shall suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant. And this isn't the only book in the Bible, of course, that speaks about covenants. But God has dealt with mankind through various covenants. Some national covenants, some were personal covenants. Did not Jephthah, in that foolish vow that he made, was that not a covenant? He said, God, if you give us the victory, I'll offer you the first thing that comes out of my house. Sadly, it was his daughter. It was a foolish vow for him to make. So why do I make all this, or bring all this up? Well, number one, when God makes a covenant, he keeps it. And he expects the people to keep their part of the covenant. The problem in Malachi's day, the people were not honoring their covenant. They were not keeping the marriage covenant as it was intended to be. We see in chapter 2, verse 11 of Malachi, Judah hath dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah hath profaned the holiness of Jehovah, which he loved, and hath married the daughter of a strange god. See, intermarriage for the Jew, intermarriage with pagans was forbidden. It was part of the covenant that God gave to Moses on Mount Sinai. Jews were not to marry outside, especially not pagans. And this was the same problem over in Ezra chapter 9. And he deals a lot with it. I hadn't intended to go there, but I'm going to look at it just briefly. In Ezra chapter 9, now when these things were done, the princes came to me saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the land, doing according to their abomination, even of the Canaanite, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites, for they have taken of their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the people of these lands. Yea, the hand of the princes and the rulers hath been chief in this trespass. They had not honored God's covenant with regard to marriage. We see in Malachi chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, yet ye say, wherefore? Because the Lord hath been witness between thee and thy wife, thy youth, against whom thou hast dealt treacherously. Yet is she thy companion and thy wife of thy covenant. And he did not make one, yet he had the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one? That he might seek a godly seed. Therefore take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth. So they had become so free in their thinking and so little disregard for the covenant of God, they were divorcing the wives of their youth that they'd had for a long time, and they were going after these pagans. Why? Well, we'll get to that in a minute. You see, according to 1 Corinthians 7, 2, and if you paid attention to the reading or read along, marriage is about more than simply satisfying physical needs. God created man and he created woman with inherent physical needs. And these needs are to be satisfied only in the confines of the marriage covenant. In fact, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 2, to prevent fornication, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. The second reason, and as we notice in verse 15, was that they might bring up godly seed. Procreation. That's part of the design of the physical relationship between a husband and a wife. For safety. That's how, that's, you know, if people would remain in committed marriages and only men and women who are married to each other had sex, there wouldn't be the sexually transmitted diseases like we see. The abortion rate would plummet. People would be a lot happier. So they were bored with their marriages. And so they turned to these exotic, pagan men and women. It was as if it was forbidden fruit. And for some reason, we always think that forbidden fruit is going to be much sweeter. It's going to be more delicious. And things haven't changed that much. Human nature hasn't changed that much in the 6,000 or 7,000 years that the earth has been populated. People say, well, you know, why are you two getting a divorce? Well, I just got bored with my spouse. I just don't love him anymore, or I just don't love her anymore. We're not in love anymore. You know, one of the things that the older women were to teach the younger wives how to do in the church was to teach them how to love their husbands. You know why they had to teach them that? Because predominantly the marriages at that time were arranged marriages. And there were many instances where the groom and the bride did not meet until the wedding day. And so they had to literally learn to love each other. And that's why I've said to you over and over that love in the Bible is not so much a feeling as it is an action. It is kindness. It is doing things. And we hear these preachers today say, well, we need to fall in love with Jesus. If you fall in love with somebody, that means you can't help it. I chose to love Jesus, and you did too. Jesus, if he wanted us to just fall in love with him and be irresistibly attracted to him, he could have created us that way. But he didn't want a bunch of mindless robots. He wanted people to choose him. And that's what we've done. We live in the days of so-called no-fault divorce. There's no such thing. That's the biggest misnomer I think I've ever heard. No-fault divorce. It just doesn't exist. Maybe it does in the laws of the land. But if we look at Matthew chapter 19, beginning in verse 3, we see that there's no such thing as no-fault divorce. The Pharisees came unto him tempting and saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? Modern translations say, for any reason. That sounds like no-fault divorce for me. Well, here's what Jesus said. Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? And for this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave unto his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. Does that sound like God agrees with something called no-fault divorce? It doesn't to me. Sounds like just the opposite. So they asked Jesus, Well, why did Moses command then to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? He said Moses didn't command them to do it. Moses, for a time, allowed it. It was his provisional will, but it was not his ultimate will. God, for a time, allowed divorce under certain circumstances, but he never approved of it. So the problem was a failure to recognize that marriage was a covenant between three: a husband, a wife, and Jehovah God. And if you break your covenant with your spouse, you have broken your covenant with Jehovah God. That's just it. But what if, no, there's no but ifs. There's no but ifs. We break a covenant with spouse, we break a covenant with God. In chapter 2 and verse 16 of Malachi, in the King James it says, "For Jehovah, the God of Israel, saith that he hateth putting away." Putting away? What's that mean? I wish I'd known that when I was a kid. I'd have told Mom, when she said, "Put away your toys," I said, "God hates putting away." But that's not what he's talking about there. If you're reading from a modern translation, it says, "God hates divorce." Underline it, circle it, highlight it, memorize it, live it. God hates divorce. We cannot overstate that fact. So these religious people had become bored with worship. They had become bored with marriage. And thirdly, in chapter 3, verses 7 through 12, they had become bored with giving of all things. Now, this may seem inconsequential, and it may even seem anticlimactic in a three-part sermon, but we need to consider this very carefully. In chapter 3, verse 7, we see God's challenge to the children. And it says, "From the days, even from the days of your fathers." Now, this is God speaking through the prophet. "Even from the days of your fathers, ye are gone away from mine ordinances and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith Jehovah of hosts. But ye said, wherein shall we return?" In other words, why do we need to repent? What have we done? And then God says in verse 8, "Will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But ye say, wherein have we robbed thee?" God said, "In tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole nation." So God challenges them. And he tells them, you need to repent. What do we need to repent of? You've been robbing me. How have we robbed you? You're not giving your tithes properly. You're not giving your offerings properly. Now, tithes, of course, was the 10% of the produce. Okay? 10% of the increase. The offerings refers to what they took to the temple for the priests to sacrifice. And God says, "You have been robbing me with this." And in verse 9, he says, "You are cursed with a curse." That doesn't sound good. "For you have robbed me, even this whole nation." It was a national phenomenon. Neither Malachi nor Jehovah had sympathy for these bored with giving ones. They had failed by their own selfishness. They had, number one, they had failed to recognize God as the source of their blessings. Read verse 10, 11, 12 with me. He says, Bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, God's house, the temple. And prove me now herewith, saith Jehovah of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour out you a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, neither shall your vine cast her fruit before the time in the field, saith Jehovah of hosts. And the nation shall call you blessed, for you shall be a delightsome land, saith Jehovah of hosts. So, in a nutshell, he said, you fail to recognize God as the source of your blessings. You fail to recognize that God owns everything. Therefore, they were robbing God of that which was rightfully his. God deserves our praise and our glory for the blessings that we have. And they just weren't doing it. And because of that, God was allowing them to suffer financially. Malachi told them that the reason was because they did not trust the Lord enough to give enough. I saw a congregation give everything in their savings account twice to disaster relief efforts. And they had several thousand dollars in their savings, or their checking, I don't know what, in their bank account. They gave every last dime on two separate occasions. Yet that congregation never failed to pay a bill. They trusted the Lord enough to give their two mites. God does not bind the tithe on us. No Christian has ever been, I remember the old preacher saying, brethren, we're not limited to a tithe anymore. We're not bound by the tithe. But God has commanded us to give liberally as we've been prospered. 1 Corinthians 16:2, 2 Corinthians 9, 6, and 7. God has promised to bless us. In Luke chapter 6 and verse 38, Jesus himself said, give and it shall be given unto you. A good measure, pressed down and shaken together. What's that mean? Did you ever wonder? The women that used to come for, the widows would come for handouts or whatever, or come to glean, and they'd sometimes have a basket. And so they would fill up the basket, and it would be full, right? But what happens if you shake the basket? It settles. And then you can press it down, and you can put more in. So then they were blessed abundantly. And that's what this is talking about. God will give us good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over. That's how men, he says, shall give into your bosom. They would lift their aprons up sometimes. If they didn't have a basket, they could lift their apron up and they could carry whatever in their apron. He says he will fill your bosom with these things. For with the same measure you mete out, it will be measured unto you again. Brethren, if we find that we are bored with giving, we need to examine our priorities. Now, it's not impossible that like these old, these Jews of old time, that we might once in a while find ourselves becoming bored with worship, bored with church. Sometimes people can get bored with their job. They'll go through a rut, and then they'll come out of it on the other side, and everything will be fine. We may find ourselves getting bored with Christianity. We cannot allow ourselves to remain bored with Christianity. When we find ourselves getting bored with Christianity, we need to start putting more into Christianity. It's not God's fault. You can blame the preacher. You can blame the song leader. You can blame the person that does the prayers. You can blame everybody. But 9 out of 7 times, if you look inwardly and put a little more out, put a little more in, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. We'll get out of it what we put into it. I hope this has been a benefit. It was a blessing for me to get to study this lesson. It helped me do some thinking. And I hope it encouraged you. That's what I designed it to do. I want you to know that it happens sometimes. But we don't have to let that define us. We don't have to let that be who we are. We get in a rut sometimes. But what do you do when you get in a rut on a dirt road? You mash the gas and keep going. You'll get out of the rut. Just put a little more into it. You'll be fine. But if you're not a Christian tonight, if you're not a Christian, if you're not a faithful Christian, things are not fine. Jesus said, "He that believes and is baptized shall be saved." If you've never put Christ on in baptism, we can only ask why. Why won't you do it tonight? If you are a child of God, but you've been unfaithful, maybe you've been bored. Maybe you need a starting point to get back on track. This is it. Dare I say it? Here's your sign. If you're subject to the Lord's invitation, we encourage you to take a seat on the front row right now as we stand and sing.